Arkansas's prison system has a high price tag, both for taxpayers and formerly incarcerated people. Backlash continues over Ten Commandments posters on the University of Arkansas campus, and we take a look at efforts to improve the maternal health landscape in Northeast Arkansas. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Brain, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Brain with Little Rock Public Radio. Policymakers and law enforcement in Arkansas may not see eye to eye on all issues, but leaders from both groups agree on one thing. The state needs more prison beds. But what exactly is behind the push, and how much is it costing Arkansans? Our partners at the Arkansas Advocate have launched a four-part series examining the state's overcrowded prisons. Today's story from the Advocate's Antoinette Grajeda looks at the cost of the state's carceral system to taxpayers and formerly incarcerated Arkansans.
It's been nearly two decades since Ruby Welch was released from prison, but she's still not free, she says, because financial and emotional burdens remain. After serving 7 years on a drug charge, Welch left prison with a $15,000 restitution that she's still paying off. Until her ledger is cleared, the Hot Springs native will remain on parole, which requires her to submit notification about out-of-state trips.
I call them my slave papers. Before I can go to anybody else's plantation, I gotta let them know that I'm leaving the plantation in Arkansas.
Since her release, Welch has become a resource for incarcerated individuals through her organization FELIN, an acronym for Formerly Incarcerated Empowered Leaders Overcoming Negative Stigmas. She's also worked on criminal justice legislation. Despite trying to move forward, Welch says she still feels like the property of the state of Arkansas because fees keep her tied to the prison system. Failure to pay fines and fees can result in more time behind bars, and Welch says there have been instances when she chose to pay fines over rent.
I packed up all my stuff, put it in storage, and I went to a homeless shelter so I could pay my fines and fees. That ought not to be. You know, people shouldn't have to live in that type of trauma on a daily basis.
Welch's experience exemplifies how expenses that accumulate inside and outside prison can keep formerly incarcerated people who may struggle to find employment stuck in the carceral system for years. Court-imposed fees, fines, and restitution are not part of the Arkansas Department of Corrections budget, according to Chief of Communications Rand Champion, who said in an email that former inmates can be required to serve the remainder of their time without a new sentence if fines and fees aren't paid in a timely manner. Champion says officers do have discretion to delay a supervision fee for those on community supervision. The $35 monthly fee, which hasn't increased since 2011, could be split into two separate payments, for example. Champion says the department routinely works with individuals to reduce or waive supervision fees if a financial hardship exists, and at times it's possible to convert those into community service work hours. People who are incarcerated can incur charges for court proceedings, restitution, parole, and a variety of services. In Arkansas, they pay a $3 copay per sick call, 6 cents per minute for phone calls, and $5 for a 30-minute video call. Adults on work release are charged a $22 daily room and board fee. There's also a range of prices for commissary products, which vary between locations and are set and approved by the Board of Corrections. Inmates can purchase writing supplies from the commissary to stay in touch with loved ones. In-person visitation is another option, if families can afford it. Almost all of the state's prisons are located in eastern or central Arkansas, which means money for gas and child care and lost wages for taking a day off work. Arkansas Justice Reform Coalition Executive Director Sarah Moore says purchasing items and services behind bars also depends on whether family members can afford to place money on inmates' accounts.
We've seen families forego, you know, paying their rents, cutting back on groceries, not being able to afford, you know, other obligations they have in their budget because they're putting hundreds of dollars on the jail commissary.
Moore says the carceral system is very extractive because it's structured to profit off of vulnerable and poor Arkansans. She says it starts with cash bail, which can leave those who are impoverished and too poor to buy their freedom behind bars for long periods of time.
They're not convicted. They're facing charges, but they deserve their liberty. They deserve to be back with their families. They deserve to be able to maintain their jobs and their housing and those familial ties, which really get ripped apart whenever they're stuck in prolonged detention, which is very common in our state.
As a nonprofit working to end mass incarceration, Moore says AJRC educates the public about the cost of the current system and the return on that investment.
And I think we are finding we don't like that. So our organization ultimately wants to create systems of care, and we really want to obliterate and abolish and end all of those that create harm in our communities and across the state.
That return on investment is part of the ongoing debate over construction of a proposed prison in Franklin County that's expected to cost around $825 million, according to preliminary estimates. Once the prison is built, there will be additional operational costs. In fiscal year 2025, the average cost per day per inmate, as well as the average cost per day per bed, was around $75. Both represent a roughly $4 increase from the previous year. Meanwhile, the total direct and indirect cost for the fiscal year that ended June 30th was $452.9 million. That represents an increase of $35.4 million from last year and $92.8 million from a decade ago. Of the increased total direct and indirect costs, 39% was attributable to increased personnel costs of salary, personal services matching, and overtime. 24% came from increased medical costs and 6% from increased overhead costs. In addition to expanding prison capacity to alleviate overcrowding in county jails, officials anticipate more space will be needed as a result of the Protect Arkansas Act, a 2023 bill that, among other things, ended parole for the state's most violent offenders and required others to serve more of their sentences. According to an analysis by consulting firm CGL, Arkansas's inmate population is expected to increase from around 20,000 today to 25,000 in 2035. According to the study, the state will need an additional 1,500 to 2,000 beds through 2040 once the PROTECT Act is fully implemented. Welch worked on a provision in the PROTECT Act that suspends fines for 120 days following a defendant's release from custody. However, Welch says she's heard feedback from people who were once incarcerated that the grace period is not always applied.
It's all about money. It's not about restoring, rehabilitation. And that's what we need to make it about.
Proponents of harsher sentencing and expanded prison capacity have argued they're needed for public safety. While Moore supports making communities safer, she says it's important to look at data to make better decisions about how taxpayer money is used to achieve that goal. Moore says the current system is punitive and accountability needs to be looked at in a different way. As an example, she points to how people can rack up debt by missing a court date, but officials don't send meeting reminders as would happen for a medical appointment. Moore also says the system is disenfranchising and keeping a certain part of the population from participating in society in a way that could help push Arkansas forward.
It's all intertwined. And again, if we look to the evidence, if we look to the outcomes, we say our recidivism is too high. I hear people saying they don't like where we're at on violent crime, but we keep pursuing the same methods. And so if we keep doing that, we're going to get the same outcomes. It's definitely time that we approach things in a different way.
That was the Arkansas Advocate's Antoinette Grajeda reporting. You can read more stories from the Overcrowded series at arkansasadvocate.com. This fall, the University of Arkansas began putting up framed posters of the Ten Commandments in each building on its campus in Fayetteville. The move is in compliance with state law. Act 573 passed during the most recent legislative session, but it's been challenged by families in several K-12 public schools across the state and was blocked by a federal judge from going into effect for those districts in August. But no lawsuit has been filed on behalf of university students. The installation of the signs has sparked backlash from some faculty and students. KUAF's Daniel Carruth reports.
It's a rainy November evening on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville as several students, faculty, and staff mingle in a third-floor lecture hall in the Human and Environmental Sciences building. Junior horticulture major Nathan Gray pulls up a slideshow before addressing the crowd. Gray is part of the recently formed student group At What Point, which opposes the installation of Ten Commandments posters in university classrooms. And tonight, he's hosting a teach-in to help update people on the state law and history of religious displays in public schools in America.
So whenever I heard about this first being implemented, I honestly kind of was shocked, and I thought it was a joke at first. And upon seeing that there weren't a whole lot of other people discussing this or bringing it up, I kind of took it upon myself to kind of organize this. And I knew that there were faculty that felt like-minded about this, as well as graduate students and alumni.
Act 573 of 2025 requires all public school classrooms and libraries, as well as institutes of higher learning, prominently display a, quote, durable poster or framed copy of a historical representation of the Ten Commandments. According to the law, those posters have to be donated or paid with by voluntary contributions. In October, the University of Arkansas received 500 donated posters from a Christian group, Counteract USA, which was founded by University of Arkansas alum Abigail Desjarnet. Out of the 11 four-year public universities in the state, the University of Arkansas Fayetteville campus is the only one which has so far received donated posters. University of Arkansas spokesperson John Thomas said in a statement that the university is in the process of hanging all of these 16 by 20-inch framed posters in accordance with state law. And since the news broke in October, Gray says the mood on campus has been tense.
I think the sponsors of this bill kind of knew that religion is a touchy subject and that people aren't willing to bring it up whenever they don't really have to. So far, the response has been almost somewhat apathetic from students because I think they might not really even know what's going on to the full extent.
Verna Lavitad is the other organizer for the student group At What Point. She says a lot of fellow students are mostly confused about the Ten Commandments going up and may not realize the precedent being set by these posters on their campus.
This affects everybody here. It affects your friends. It affects the community. It doesn't matter what religion or wherever you come from. It affects you because it affects your constitutional rights. And the student body should care about that, because if we don't advocate for our own rights, who will?
And that's why she and Gray wanted to hold a teach-in to help give context to the situation and hear from others of the campus community. The two speakers who presented tonight include University of Arkansas law professor John Thorlin and music professor Stephen Caldwell.
I am just disappointed that the university has not offered an explanation. If they are going to violate our constitutional rights, I believe that we deserve to know why.
Caldwell sponsored a faculty senate resolution opposing the new law back in May. He is also a plaintiff in the lawsuit Stinson v. Fayetteville School District No. 1 on behalf of his son, which was argued before the Western District of Arkansas in July. In August, the court issued a preliminary injunction blocking the display in certain school districts across the state of Arkansas. Caldwell says the decision by the university to put up the Ten Commandments is perplexing, especially as many K-12 schools in the state have opted to wait until the pending lawsuit is settled.
The biggest point here is that this has been litigated over and over and over again. Stone v. Graham ruled in 1980 that the Ten Commandments in public schools is illegal and a violation of the constitutional rights. The conversation ends there until such time as the Supreme Court overrules itself, and they are the only entity that can overrule itself. And so there's a great model for this in the last few years in the abortion debate. So as Roe v. Wade remained good law, and states, especially in the South, started passing anti-abortion laws, none of those laws laws could go into effect until such time that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, which they did in the Dobbs decision, and then the states who passed those laws could put those laws into effect. This is an almost identical situation where we have a Supreme Court precedent, which is clear, which is in good standing. And yet, we have institutions that are knowingly and willingly complying with a law they know to be unconstitutional.
And while most everyone here tonight opposes the posters, the argument for putting them up, according to the drafters of that original legislation, is that it promotes good moral grounding and civic education. Speaking during a legislative committee meeting in April, the bill's sponsor, Representative Alyssa Brown, a Republican from Heber Springs, said the posters are an attempt to educate students on how the U.S. Constitution was framed.
You cannot separate the history of our nation and the founding of our law and justice system from the Ten Commandments. We send our kids to D.C. to go learn about the history of our nation, where they will go to places like the National Archives, or the House floor there in the Capitol, or even the United States Supreme Court, the highest court in our land. In each of those places, they will see depictions of the Ten Commandments.
But Caldwell disagrees that these posters, which display text of a core tenet from the Christian faith, are at all secular.
And the Constitution says that that is illegal. The Constitution says Congress shall make no law, the government shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And to put a poster in a public classroom that states, I am the Lord thy God, and thou shalt have no other gods before me, is the government establishing a religion, which is clearly unconstitutional.
And the state law also carries no explicit penalties for institutions that do not display the posters. But anyone on campus who tampers with the displays could be subject to criminal vandalism charges because the posters are state property. And two graduate students who declined to be interviewed on record for this report said during the teach-in that they've been instructed to report any graffiti, moving, or tampering of the posters by students to their supervisors. Verna Lavitad says despite attempts to contact university administration, she and her group have not had any communication, but says the next step is to keep pushing for answers.
We are actually trying to get three petitions going. One of them is to remove the posters before the next two that I'm going to talk about, which are the open forum petitions. Basically, we want to get an open discussion going with the university itself and like get that sort of on document, since they haven't posted any public statement besides just we're complying with the law.
And while the future of the Ten Commandments displays on the university campus is still up in the air, Act 573 is similar to laws in Texas and Louisiana, which are all on similar tracks toward each of their circuit courts of appeals. If the circuit courts issue conflicting decisions or states continue to appeal this historical argument, the issue will likely land before the U.S. Supreme Court.
That was KUAF's Daniel Carruth reporting. The state of Arkansas continues to roll out a new program aimed at boosting maternal health outcomes. KASU's Lexi Burns spoke with Emily McGee, Vice President of Nursing and Women's and Children's Services at St. Bernard's Regional Medical Center in Jonesboro, about the recent expansion of its Maternal Life 360 home program.
For those who may not know, could you give a little bit of background about what this program is and how it came to be?
It actually starts as a nation. We have opportunities with maternal and infant mortality. As a state, Arkansas is one of the highest rates of infant and maternal mortality. So it was very important for the government to put in pieces to help us improve. And so through CMS, we were funded as a nation and allotted to provide service to expecting mothers and their children. So in November of 2024, we went live with our Maternal Life 360 program. And what that does is for any Medicaid enrollees, we are able to partner with Parents as Teachers, and which is a home teaching network. And so while we at the pregnancy clinic see patients in the clinic, we have these teachers who go into the home and they see, does baby have a safe place to sleep? Does mom have transportation to appointments? Do you have stable housing? Do you actually, you know, do you have a house or apartment? Are we living in our car? You know, what can we do as a group along with parents as teachers to be able to provide that care while mom is pregnant, but up to 2 years of age for a baby once they join us in the world?
So would you say that this program can be tailored to each mother, their babies, and what situations they're in?
So it absolutely can be tailored. So to a point, when a mom is at the pregnancy clinic, so they go through and assess, it's I think a 7-page document on different social determinants of health. You know, like I mentioned earlier, do they have transportation? Do they have a safe place? Do they have employment? Do they have internet service? Like, do they have language barriers? Just different types of things that would make them eligible for this program. And so once Parents as Teachers makes contact and goes into their home, they have a standard way of identifying those needs in the house. And so whereas one mom may need education on interviewing skills to get gainful employment, another mom may need to know, you know, how do I get childcare? What do I do once the baby gets here? So their plan of education is determined by each patient's independent needs.
So could you be more specific about what ways this program addresses the social determinants of health that can impact pregnancy and infants?
Absolutely. So looking at pregnancy, it's important that they continue with their prenatal care. So while they're pregnant, they're coming to their doctor, they're getting their blood pressure checked, they're making sure they're healthy along with baby. And so where we weren't able to go into the homes prenatally, Parents as Teachers goes in and, you know, mom may come into the clinic and say, absolutely, I can get my own food. I have no problem having a nutritious diet. I have a stable place to live. I have running water. And Parents as Teacher goes in and they're able to see, maybe we don't have electricity. Maybe we don't have water and we don't have access to food. And so through that, they're able to drive them and help find ways of transportation, stable living, and just the environment that that mom truly needs to have a healthy baby and remain healthy herself.
That was Emily McGee with St. Bernard's Regional Medical Center in Jonesboro speaking with KASU's Lexi Burns. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.